Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, always a deep pleasure to talk to him. Bernd Heinrich, acclaimed scientist, natural historian, the author of numerous books, and we're going to be talking about his latest book, White Feathers, The Nesting Lives of Tree Swallows. Bernd, it is such a pleasure to talk to you again, and especially about this book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Happy to be on.
Now, when I picked this up and I saw it was a book about tree swallows, I said, "What? That's like the most studied bird in the world. What possibly could you learn that's new about tree swallows?" And damned, you did.
Yes. Well, I had no idea. I mean, I just saw the swallow, and I thought, what the heck is this doing? This male swallow was bringing in white feathers, so, you know, birds line their nest with feathers, so what? But, you know, they were kind of dropping in front of the nest box, and I looked at some other boxes and other birds, and they don't use any white feathers, and I didn't find any white feathers anywhere around. I says, what the hell is going on? Where are they coming from and why? So I said, well, I'll just watch and see what happens.
And the amazing thing is there was nothing in the literature up until your observations that even talked about this.
Well, the thing is, I tell you the truth, I didn't know what was in the literature about tree swallows. I really didn't want to know all the theories. I knew a little bit about them, but I never heard about anything about white feathers. Anything could happen, and I didn't want to be too prejudiced.
Well, you know, I've observed these huge fall migrating flocks on like Plum Island, and among those, I've seen a lot of what looks like play with the white feather. Like one will carry a white feather up and then drop it, and then other ones will zoom in. But that's the only thing I ever knew about tree swallows and white feathers.
Same here. That's the only thing I heard about them too, Interesting that it didn't seem to be associated with nesting at all.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now let's set the stage for the listeners. We're talking about your cabin up in Maine. You're not right next to a marsh or anything, are you?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm right in the middle of the woods. It's a clearing, about an acre clearing, with thick, tall trees all around. So it's not the usual. We expect. I mean, I think of all the studies were done in big open areas.
Yeah.
Usually next to a marsh or something like that, or a lake.
And how many nest boxes do you have up?
I had boxes up for bluebirds and chickadees and everything else, that I was expecting. And I had about, I think I had 8 boxes up, and only one was ever used by tree swallows. But you know, they were always tree swallows around, and they were fighting like crazy over one box, even though there were others available. So that's right off tipped me off that something interesting was going on.
It is. It sounds very unusual for tree swallows, because I've noticed some places like big open areas, like you mentioned, like in reservoirs,
yes,
where there's lines,
yes,
of tree swallow, yes, boxes.
Yes.
But it seems like it's because of the habitat, maybe?
Yeah, I think, swallows like open areas. They're definitely not in the woods. So they like open areas. That's where they can catch flying insects. So they're, definitely habitat specific.
Now let's talk about the tree swallows. And people who've never seen tree swallows closely, they are beautiful birds, and they're very vocal.
Yeah, they had. I love the song of the males. The kind of a twittering song. It's very, yeah, very, very kind of attractive. I like it. And they have all kinds of other calls. I can't mimic them all.
Now, what I love about you is when you set your mind on a project, you're like a dog with a bone. I mean, you go about this tenaciously. I mean, I don't know any other person like you, Bernd. It's like, yeah, I heard it's dawn, it's like 5:30 in the morning or 4, and you hear the first tree swallow, you're out there in your chair, you're sitting there with your coffee, and you're watching them and making notes. It's incredible. People have got to understand, you're really closely observing this. And it's such a different study And you mentioned this in the book. When I read studies about tree swallows, it's about a bunch of tree swallow boxes, and people are making general observations.
Right, right.
You're watching a pair intently.
Yeah. I can't leave the things. I know the individuals. And actually, it was even before 4 o'clock in the morning. I've heard them. You know, I think it was 3 o'clock. It was still night. I mean, because the cabin is right there. I have the window open. I could hear one twittering or calling, pre-dawn. And so that really got me interested. But only at a very certain times of the nesting cycle. So all these interesting things happening that I hadn't heard about.
Now, I don't know, it must be true for you up in Maine too, but here in central Massachusetts, in the middle of the state, the timing of the arrival of the first tree swallows and their nesting success is critical. Sometimes several pairs will arrive, what I consider to be a little bit on the early side, and then a big bout of like cold and wet weather will happen, and there'll be a high mortality.
Yes. They have to be very early. I mean, they're kind of in a bind because they're insect eaters, and so they have to catch flying insects, so that means they should come late when the insects are flying. On the other hand, they have very specific nesting site preferences, and there's competition for the nest sites. So they have to beat the competition. That's why they have to be there early, and there is quite a bit of mortality, as I told about in the book.
Now, what's the average date for the arrival where you are?
Well, I don't have the dates in mind right now, but I would say like mid-April.
Okay, but the weather and the weather here can be very variable. When do you know what is it? The males that show up first.
I don't recall specifically. I don't think it was just the males. I think the females were coming early too.
Okay.
And
so, do they arrive prepared up?
Not necessarily. I quite a few times saw a single one come, and it would be there for a few days, and then you know the weather would change, and then it would leave and come back. Not necessarily in pairs.
Now, one of the things I learned out of your book is their mating and their nesting gets incredibly complicated because of extra pair copulation and brood parasitism. Let's define those terms so the audience will understand. Let's talk about extra pair copulation.
Well, I mean, that is one of the topics that have been, seems to me, of most interest to most people who were studying tree swallows. I think there's something like 64 publications on extra pair copulation. I don't see why it's so darn interesting. you kind of might expect it. It happens in many birds. But actually, I never saw it. I never saw it.
But you did have interlopers come in every once in a while.
Yeah, I saw interlopers, but they got chased out and they got fought. But I didn't see copulations of outside the pair.
But you did see nest parasitism.
I think so. In fact, I tried to find it, but I'm not positive.
Right.
But I think there was, but I can't be positive because once you drop an egg in there, the eggs all look exactly the same. And so it's going to be hard to tell.
Well, this brings up an interesting point. And this was another crucial thing that you learn is that the size of the brood really determines the overall nesting success for that year.
Yes. If they have slightly too many, then potentially the whole clutch could starve. However, since they're nesting in the cavity, they can pare down the brood size to a more manageable number if there's a bad year, because one of the young will be hogging the nest entrance, and so all the others starve to death. If there are too many. And if there's enough food, then the birds will stay down, down in the nest box and all get fed. So if it's a good year, whether it's good, they all get fed, and if it's not, then it really gets pared down. So I was surprised at the mortality due to bad weather when there were, you know, too many young.
There's some incredible scenes in this book, and there's one where I think the nesting pair of that year had four young, and all of a sudden you looked in, and I think there was only two young.
Yeah.
And was your feeling that the adults got rid of the extra two?
I think so. Yeah, I think.
Wow.
I think it. I mean, I don't want to go into the details of the scenario, but I think sometimes there might be an extra egg dropped in a little bit late, and it hatches a little bit late, and then they're very alert. I think for you know nest parasitism, and then they might actually scarf up one of the babies. I mean, that's what happened for sure with the chickadee that hatched. I mean, baby chickadee hatching looks much like a swallow, but I'm sure it disappeared. And so the same with the swallows. One of the babies, the little babies, disappeared.
Did the chickadee nest lay the egg in the nest box?
Yeah, they.
That's the first, Bernie. That's the first time I've ever heard about chickadees doing brood parasitism.
Well, I don't know who was parasitizing whom.
So the chickadee was there first, and the tree swallows came later.
I think so. Yeah. But I don't remember the details at this point. But I've seen it a couple of times.
But other times when there's failure and young die, when you open the nest box, you find the dead corpse of the baby in there.
Yes, that happened quite a lot, quite a lot.
It's amazing because it really had. There's so many factors that it's dependent upon: the weather, food availability, a lot of things. And let's talk about when they first come in and when they finally decide to nest. There's a lot of perching together. You have like one tree, I think it's a locust tree, just sort of sitting. There's this wonderful thing where they'll sit this one particular branch, just before they've decided to nest.
Well, yeah, one pair would always be on this branch on this locust tree. They like to be out in the open, so maybe there's something special about it. But then it turned out another year, another pair was on another tree up in the maple, and then another year there was another pair, and there was always on the apple tree. So they had they're very kind of set in their habits.
So when they first decide to nest, who starts bringing nesting materials to the box? Male or female, or both?
Actually, it's only the female that was bringing nesting materials, except that the male was sometimes later on bringing feathers. But the male would definitely instigate. He might initially pick up a piece of grass, but not really bring it in, but kind of feign like he was going to, and when she would go down and go pick up a piece of straw, he would start singing and singing his approval, and so he's kind of guiding her. That's what it looked like.
Is it always the same kind of grasses that they're nesting?
Well, no. There were differences. Like one year they were using pine needles, another year they started on dry grass. And I would actually see if they had a preference by putting out different materials to see if they were wanted, you know, what's just available, or if they had a preference.
Do you think that was the same pair, or do you think it was different pairs had different preferences?
I think different pairs had different preferences.
That's fascinating. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Bernd Heinrich, acclaimed scientist, natural historian, the author of numerous great books. And we're talking about his latest, White Feathers, The Nesting Lives of Tree Swallows. Bernd, this is where it gets... There are several points in your book that were just wild. But this whole thing about the white feathers, when do they start incorporating, at what point in the nest building do they start incorporating these white feathers?
Well, they often, you know, after the eggs were laid, and I try to you know, find out when they were doing that by presenting them with feathers at different times. And if I took the feathers out, they would still be bringing them in, you know, even after they'd been incubating for a long time. So it's basically after the eggs were laid.
Where are they getting these feathers?
Yeah, this is one of the questions that I had that really got me fascinated, because white feathers are rare, especially out in the woods. And anyway, it turned out that that most of them happen to be waterfowl.
So they're traveling a distance to the nearest marsh?
Nearest marsh, and the nearest marsh was about a mile away. So they were coming from a long distance. But, of course, they would like him right up close. So if I dropped him right by the box, they would take him from there. And, in fact, I was feeding one male right out of my hand. I got him used to me as soon as they came in the spring. And he would actually flutter in front of me after a while and say, "Where's my feather? You know, I want my feather." and I'd give him one.
Well, in typical Bernd Heinrich fashion, whenever there's a situation like this, you start setting up variables and see what happens. Yeah. So, is it always a white feather?
No. I mean, I tried different colors. I wanted to see if they have a preference. You know, I put out, let's say, a white sheet, and I put on black feathers. So I had a black sheet and put on white feathers, and just to change the situation to see if they were looking at the contrast or the color as such.
Was the contrast important?
It was important, but still there was a residual preference for the white.
Did you try any other colors other than black and white?
No.
And by the way, the reason you have feathers is you found a roadkill duck, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bernd is never one to waste anything if there's a way to incorporate it into a study.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I found a roadkill duck, and it was, you know, domestic, and it had had dark feathers and white feathers. Holy shit. Yeah, I can have a control the same bird, same type of feathers, only different colors. So that's where I started with the color preferences.
By the way, we should mention, you know, people are listening to this and going, you got really close to these swallows. You acclimated them to your presence.
Right.
Talk to me how you did that.
Well, as soon as they arrived in the spring, I made sure that I was out there all the time, just kind of sitting there. So I would be like a stump to them, and so they would get totally used to me, and they would, you know, after a while ignore me. In fact, I got to the point where, you know, the bird would always be sitting on this post, for example, near the bird box, and I would gradually get closer and closer and just be sitting. I mean, I'd spend days out there, and after a while he totally ignored me, and I got to the point where I actually could reach up and touch him on the tail.
And when you opened the nest box to check on the nestlings, if she was incubating them, they wouldn't move.
No, they wouldn't move. In fact, I can even nudge my finger under her and see what's under there. So
now, when people read this book, you get emotionally involved, it's because we're human. In the success of this, and so many different things happen, and every year it's a different story.
Right.
But there's one incident that happens, you know what's coming.
Yeah, I know.
It's like
the fledging, right?
What?
The fledging?
No.
No. What's that?
The Nigrophorus pustulatus.
Oh boy, yeah.
Man, first of all, you'd never even seen that species before, had you?
No, I've never seen one.
Okay, we gotta back this up so the audience knows what we're talking about. See, you're checking on the nest box. There had been the healthy nestlings in there one day.
Yeah, in the evening. I checked. Yeah.
And then the next day,
what
did you find?
they were all dead and bloodied, and there was this beetle on them.
It's and for people who aren't familiar with sexton beetles, these are the burying beetles. You wrote a book that talked a lot about burying beetles.
Right, right.
But this is a very odd burying beetle. It has a very odd habitat and life cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. It instead of burying small carcasses of birds and rodents, etc., it parasitizes turtle eggs. They're already buried, and it, you know, it apparently the lays its eggs on it, and they eat the embryos, I guess.
Well, it's no wonder that you've never seen this, because it sounds like it lives a very secretive lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, you don't attract it by putting out mice and little bird carcasses.
So
like
I got, I had so many questions about this. Okay. Mm-hmm. First of all, I thought it was so cool that you saw that species, because that would have excited me.
Yeah.
Do you think the beetle killed the young?
Well, I couldn't believe a beetle could kill them like that. I just couldn't believe, but that was the only thing there. But anyway, I don't know if I should give away what I think eventually happened. Or should
Don't give it away.
Okay.
But that has to have been the most unexpected thing that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, what a first of all, how did it even find the nest box?
Exactly. Yeah, this really puzzled me. But again, I'll leave it to the readers.
But you know, this is the advantage of doing this kind of vertical study, because you make so many observations.
Yeah.
There are these surprises and really interesting things that lead to more questions and more questions and more questions.
Right.
This doesn't come out of your usual study where you're studying 50 nesting boxes at all.
Right. No, it wouldn't. No, because you would ignore that, because not part of your question.
That's right. So. It would be the odd thing that you wouldn't, it would be outside the realm of what you're looking at.
Right.
Oh, my God. Well, people are going to have to find out. Now, fledging time comes, and man, that is a tense time. And I've watched fledging in tree swallow boxes, and how did the adults coax the young out of the nest?
Well, first of all, they get them really hungry. They stop feeding, then they kind of try to lure them out with food and just come by and flutter in front of them and fly away. And in this case, you know, sometimes even bring a bigger insect and hold it right in front of them and fly off.
But because the young hatch asynchronously, there's always going to be one that hasn't developed as fully.
They actually hatch pretty synchronous. I mean, the whole idea of the birds, they always try to they don't usually start incubating until all the eggs are laid, so they should hatch within a couple of hours, very, very closely together.
But there's, especially in these larger broods of four, it seems like one is sort of the runt.
Yeah, well, it is. In the tree swallow, there's always, I mean, very often is a runt or a couple of runts, but that is because when they get older, and there's less food, then one of them will hog the entrance. And then the others don't get fed.
There are numerous scenes, because you studied these birds over the years. For me, this was the tensest moment of their nesting cycle, because some birds get out and fly and then are taken. And then some sort of fly weakly and then down into a bush, and then some just don't even make it up to the nesting hole.
Yeah, exactly. And some don't. Some even die like the day before.
I know.
Almost. Yeah, yeah.
It's and varies from year to year and pair to pair.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a totally different, unique experience.
Yeah.
When they, the successful ones that fledge, what's their next stage before they, from migration? Did they stay with the parents for a while?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they always left the clearing. I mean, as soon as they fledged, the parents took them off. I mean, usually when they come out, if it's normal and they have been well fed, The parents lure them out, and the babies fly like adults. It's hard to tell the difference. They're perfectly good flyers, and they might roost there on the tree for an hour or so, or immediately fly off, and they take off. And I presume they take them maybe to a beaver bog or someplace where there might be more insects. I don't know. But they left the clearing, and almost always, as soon as they left, I'd never see them again. Except for the ones that are left behind. And that was the interesting thing, is that that the parents always came back if there was anyone left behind. And they'd even spend days at it to try to get it out, either get it out alive or dead, and then they leave. But they come back to the one that's left.
And for people who've never seen these enormous congregations of in fall, in early fall, of tree swallows. In Massachusetts, we have it in Plum Island, but you can also see it down in Westport and stuff like that. There are sometimes thousands.
Millions.
Yeah, and they're sort of staging for migration there, and then they move south. How far south do they go?
Well, I know they go all the way down to Louisiana, down in the sugarcane fields. They're famous for down there, and in Florida. And maybe even further south, I don't know, but they go thousands of miles.
It's amazing. We are completely out of time. We could be talking about this forever, but you got to read this book, because first of all, just to find out what happened with that Sexton beetle, it's bizarre. My returning guest tonight is Bernd Heinrich, acclaimed scientist, natural historian, and the author of numerous books. Talking about his latest book, it's the kind of book I love because it'll get you to observe nature more closely. Everybody knows tree swallows, but how closely are you watching them? White Feathers, The Nesting Lives of Tree Swallows. Bernd, it's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Mark. Pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch.